I'm Patrice Rothbaum, and we're talking today with Glenn Neely, a premier Elliott Wave analyst and founder of NeoWave Inc. and the NeoWave method of trading and forecasting. Glenn, thank you very much for being here today.
Hi, Patrice. I appreciate you doing this. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Excellent. And I understand that we're going to have a complete departure on our topic today. Our topic is What's Plaguing America? A Philosophical Discussion of Effective Government. So, Glenn, as you mentioned, you've been thinking about this for a while. What are you thinking about with this effective government?
Well, it's been something that plagued me for a long time, and wondering, you know, why is the U.S. government not working well? Most people complain about, you know, the lobbyists. They complain about Washington not listening to them. They complain about corporations having too much influence over the politicians and the political process and the lawmaking process. And so I've studied this for a long time, and there's maybe a couple of years ago that I finally came across some information that I haven't heard anybody ever talk about on television for my entire life. And it was based on a very subtle but interesting event that happened back in the 1930s. And the more I read about it, the more I realized that this is really the problem with America and why things aren't going the way the majority of people would like them to go. You know, this is not a Democratic issue or a Republican issue or a party issue at all. It's a better government for the people issue. And so I thought it was just really time to talk about this. I've been writing on it for a while, but because I take so long to get things properly written, I just worry about every word used and how it's said, that I just decided an interview might get the information out sooner. And in the current political environment, I felt there might be greater interest now to do it than to do it later.
So there's a lot of different issues out there, like whether large corporations and lobbyists have too much power. Clearly, voters feel disaffected, disenfranchised.
Yeah, they feel their vote doesn't count.
Yeah. So, and you were just saying, so this specific idea that you want to introduce and have, you know, really let us start thinking about and talking about specifically revolves around better government for the people.
Yeah, for everyone, not for any particular political group. If we go way back in time, it was back in, it was back in 1773 that America went through its Boston Tea Party revolt, and that revolt was based on taxation without representation, complaining that the British colonists didn't have any say-so in the rules and laws that they had to follow. And so, you know, that sort of started the whole process of America becoming America and led to the eventual creation of the U.S. Constitution in 1787 that formed the United States. And everything, I think, worked great and fine for a while. The Constitution was extremely well designed. It really controlled the power of government. It gave the people a great say-so in how the country was run. And that worked for a really long time. But one little change that took place back around 1930, there's some debate about the exact day and year. It's 1929, 1930, 1931, but somewhere right around that area, that the Congress decided to do something that nobody talks about, and it was an internal decision, and it was not actually against the Constitution, but it wasn't the intent of the founders of the Constitution. Their decision was to halt the number of people that could be present in the House of Representatives, or that would be allowed in the House of Representatives, and they stopped it at 435 right around the year 1930. And it has stayed that amount ever since. And so we've had this very slow and insidious process that is almost outside of the realm of observation, because it's taken place over nearly 100 years, where the population of the U.S. has continued to grow way beyond what it was in 1930, but the number of people representing the population has stayed the same.
So, Glenn, if I could interject, so that we had the founders of our country put together the Constitution. We had independence. We've got a nation based on representation. And so as the population of our country has increased, since, you know, 1777, the Constitution, whatever the exact date was. So as the population increased, the number of representatives in the U.S. House of Representatives was increasing as well. And apparently the ratio, so there was a specific ratio that was increasing as well. So the House of Representatives over that first century or you know, 150 years or so, the number of representatives would continue to increase proportionate to the population.
Absolutely. That was the intent of the Founding Fathers. If anyone listening to this goes to their Constitution, Article 1, Section 3 recommends or suggest that there should be one representative for every 30,000 people in the general population. They also recommended that it would not exceed 50 or 60,000 to avoid disenfranchisement, you might say, of the population where votes would begin to not count after a certain level where one person would be representing too many. Sort of the way the president represents everyone and a senator represents half of all the people in the state. Because it's two per state. So the more people or the fewer people in the House compared to the general population, then the more power that representative has. And the actual number of people in the House began to increase around 1843 and slowly increased and has been increasing pretty much ever since. But it didn't reach a point where it was inconsistent with the Constitution or way out of balance until about the 1930s, and that's when the size of the House of Representatives was maxing out on the number of people they could hold. And so they just decided they were going to cap it, not really probably understanding what that was going to mean over the next 80 years as the population in the U.S. exploded.
So they capped the number of representatives to 435. So that was
right.
1929 or 1930. And so what happened is because we became because of the country continuing to grow so much, so our population has been going leaps and bounds since the early 1900s.
Right.
Large population growth, whereas the House of Representatives, which is specifically set up to represent us, was capped at 435. So what did that mean in terms of how many people were being represented by our official elected politicians?
Well, based on the population at the time, it was around 100 million around the time of this law change, and now it's more than tripled since then. And even back around 1930, the number of people representing in the House was far less than 1 per 30,000. So it had slowly degraded over a period from about 1843 to 1930, more and more people were represented by fewer and fewer people in the House, but then they just decided to cap it, and they just completely disconnected from the recommendation in the U.S. Constitution. And now there is really no comparison to what the founders intended and what we have now. So we basically almost have like a parliament with very few people representing a whole bunch of people, and then we have the Senate, which is extremely, you could say elitist because it's just two people representing an entire state. Their purpose is more to represent the state's interests, not the people's interests. And then the House, of course, was there to initiate laws and reflect the majority's desires. And so if you had true representation, well right now, let me say what the current representation level is right now. Right now you have one person in the House on average per every 700,000 U.S. citizens.
Okay, and let me interject because the framers of the Constitution said that ideally it would be one representative for every 30,000 people, but no more than 50 to 60,000. And
exactly.
What we have now is, on average, one representative for every 700,000 people.
That's right. And states like Montana, because you can't divide a person into two parts, only have one person in the House of Representatives representing 1 million people, and they actually have more people in the Senate than they do in the House. So that's not at all. Well, the whole intention was to have a much larger number in the House so that all the laws would be created only when a majority of the people in the country wanted a law to be passed. And then after that majority wanted something, then they can pass it to the elite category, which would be more focused on the state and maybe the rich and powerful, which would be the Senate. Then they could also say, okay, we agree, but as it stands now, so few people are in the House of Representatives per the general population that they become bribable. It's a very, you know, let's say that half the people in the House want to vote on something, vote yes for something, and half want to vote no, then you only have to be a lobbyist and go and, you know, lobby a few people and pay them tons of money potentially, or wine and dine them, or whatever they might do to get them to vote, to get enough to switch over to your side to get something passed. Or if you're a representative and you want to make a deal with another person because you really want a law passed, you can just walk across the hallway in the House of Representatives or in their offices and buildings and go make deals with people to get laws passed that the majority doesn't want. And so that's where all the problems have started. It's been a slow, insidious, destructive process now for over 80 years.
So part of what, so there's, I think there's two main different points that I'm hearing. One is the individual people are not being represented at the level that we, that the framers of the Constitution initially said. So
right.
They were saying approximately 30,000 people, you know, one representative for approximately 30,000 people, no more than 50 to 60. So we were, as a smaller group, a smaller group of us had representation versus 700,000, or in Montana's case, a million of us who only have one person represented. So how can that, you know, so what I'm hearing here is a major issue is one representative. How is it possible for one representative to as fully and appropriately represent, you know, 700,000 people?
Yeah, it's impossible.
And
so,
that's what you're saying, too, what I'm hearing is that we have a handful of people in the House of Representatives, 435, and so because there's a relatively smaller number, it's lobbyists and people in power have more acts, you know, have possibly, because of the way it's, because it was capped, lobbyists and people in power possibly have more sway, more ability to lobby and influence than those of us who are supposed to be represented.
Right. Well, lobbyists wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for the current structure of the House of Representatives, because there would be no benefit. Based on the framers' recommendation of 1 per 30,000, if we were still following that, the House of Representatives would currently be over 10,300 people based on the census approximate population of the U.S. in 2011. So with 10,000 plus people, there's no lobby in the world that could visit all those people quick enough to get any laws passed that they wanted to, nor would they have enough money to bribe 10,000 people. And this would immediately start to deconstruct the power in Washington. The lobbyists would begin to leave because it would just be too expensive and too time-consuming to visit and, you know, chat with and try to influence 10,000 people. So any small organization certainly would have to leave. And because the money and the lobbyists would begin to leave Washington, then the actual representatives would have to also leave, because there wouldn't be any advantage for them staying in Washington. Most representatives now stay in Washington the majority of the year, and they're only in their own state for, you know, portions of the time, because all the money and power and, quote, fun is all in Washington. But if the lobbyists were gone, the money was gone, the corporations no longer could apply their influence, the rich and powerful and maybe even the criminal elements couldn't scare people into doing what they wanted because there'd be too many people to have to influence, then all these people would begin to leave. And if they leave, then the representatives would just go back home. And if they go back home, then you and I can actually talk to them. And we can actually have our say-so. And if one person is only representing 30,000 people or so in their own community, they could get a pretty good idea of what that community specifically wants. And you could say that, you know, 30,000 people might be the size of a small town or a big neighborhood if it's New York City. But it'd be easy for anyone who's really passionate about something or something's really important. They could actually go and see their representative in person in their own district, in their own state, and have their say-so, and the person would then be able to have town hall meetings, have local events and find out what people want. They could even vote locally to tell them what they want, and then that person could truly represent the public. But now when one person has too much power, what are you going to do if you're a representative? Even if 90% of your constituents want something to happen, but somebody offers you $1 million to vote the other way, what are you going to do?
So your main point here is that we, you know, have a really different way of looking at, well, different for us who live in the 21st century. So have a different way of looking at how the House of Representatives is structured, and how, and the number of representatives that there would be, based on the fact that maybe we take 30,000 people or 50,000 or 60, and for each little group of 30, let's say 30,000 people, there is a person in the House of Representatives representing us. And I really clearly hear your point is that they're certainly more in touch with us, the individuals, the voters, the people who, you know, populate this country, and would certainly be much more representative of what we want.
Of localized needs. Remember, there'll be individual localized needs. Every city, you know, they might have water work problems or financial problems, but it would be very local and important to those local people that have no importance to somebody in another state. So the person representing would be very in touch with that group. That group would know how he's voting because they would be the ones telling him how to vote. And if he doesn't vote the way that 30,000 wants him to, then they can easily get rid of him next time. But now you're in a situation where it's impossible for one person to represent 700,000 or a million people. So they can do pretty much anything they want. And then, you know, maybe half of the people are for it or the other half is for it. And so the bribery and the corruption element and lobbying factor takes over to a great extent because they're going to do what's going to make them personally the most money, since most people aren't keeping track of what they're doing. They're not in Washington, D.C. They can't talk to them. They can't meet with them. They don't have any idea what's going on. This change in representation, which, by the way, is not changing what was intended. It's going back to what was intended. So we would just be reverting back to the original intent of the Founding Fathers. But this would solve an enormous number of problems. Have you ever heard of the concept of gerrymandering?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, which gerrymandering exists because we don't have enough representation. If you divided a state in the case of New York City, let me look at my details here real quick. New York City currently has, I think, a total of, I think it's 67 people in the House of Representatives. Give me one second, I need to look up the number. It's a very small number, though. Do you see it in the literature that I gave you?
No, let's move on, Glenn, because I actually have two really burning questions, and I'm pretty sure our listeners would, too.
Okay. So, well, I did find it. The Constitution, New York City alone has 27 people in the House of Representatives, only 27 for a state of 19 million-plus people. And if it were based on the 30,000 rule, they would have 647. So that means just the state of New York would have more people in the House of Representatives than the entire House and Senate for the entire country. And that's just one state. So if you divided New York into 647 districts, the idea of gerrymandering just becomes useless. So you want to have these committees to divide up states. It would be very simple. And it doesn't matter. You have an extra 10 in one section or an extra 10 in another, but the gerrymandering would all come to an end, and that would just be one of the many aspects that gets fixed from this process.
So the one major burning question that I have is kind of putting it back in context with the framers of the Constitution. You know, in 1777 or 1776.
1787 was when the Constitution was...
So in that era, we were a very rural society,
yes.
And since then we have become an extremely urban society, and they could never have foreseen the population explosion, you know, that this, you know, and the addition of all these states that we have. We now have 50 states, the continent plus Hawaii plus Alaska. you know, as this, you know, massive population that we have today. And so, you know, we're real different than what they had initially envisioned. But let's say that we are able to go back to what they envisioned. We have, you know, the benefits of every 30,000 people having a representative. And I think you mentioned the number earlier of 10,000 representatives. So my major burning question is, how is that even possible to have a House of Representatives with 10,000 representatives?
Well, obviously, they wouldn't all be in Washington, D.C. At the same time, and they shouldn't be. And we should really not think of Washington, D.C. as being the seat of government anymore, because that is a centralized, power-centric kind of perspective, which is not what the founders intended at all. Their whole point was to limit the size of the national government, not let it explode and control every issue of our lives the way it practically does now. So the voting would be more localized. There's even been introduced the idea of having four districts or more for the entire country, so there'd be not just one Washington, D.C., but there might be four or five or six of them all around the country. So it automatically decentralizes their power. If there has to be an in-person vote, then the people in each area can just go to their local Washington, D.C., instead of having to fly to Washington like they do now. So it doesn't have to be where everyone goes to Washington. That actually makes us more susceptible to the country from terrorist attacks and things like that. So having this decentralization and having representatives stay in their own areas and their own districts would also reduce the terrorism threat to America from, you know, every perspective. So there's so many advantages to this process, and they could easily vote over the Internet, that there's no reason not to really seriously consider making this happen. And I think it's the only way that Americans, as the pub from a public perspective, will really take control of their lives and the lawmaking process and making sure that corruption all stops in Washington, and the lobbyists all leave, and the power structure moves back to the states and local cities and districts, which is what the founders intended initially.
So you mentioned, for example, on a practical matter, of voting over the Internet. So now that we have video conferencing and you know, clearly the Internet and email,
right,
and so forth, that it seems like, luckily, if we were able to go back to this philosophical idea of, you know, the more true representation, we actually have the technology in place,
yes,
today that would support it on a practical matter.
Right. And if it had to be kept private and, you know, sort of a red phone kind of a security system, then, you know, there could be theoretically even be meeting places in every state where the representatives of that state would meet, and the whole country would vote from these centralized, highly secure, you know, locations where they can make sure there's no shenanigans going on with the votes and stuff, and, you know, any kind of internet security issues involved.
So another question then is just not from a practical standpoint of technology, but from a group standpoint of how would, what's our number, 10,000 people? How would 10,000 representatives get anything done working together?
Well, that's sort of the whole point. When it comes to the way that politics works now, you don't want your representatives wheeling and dealing with other people. That's not the point of representative government. The point of representative government is each group has its yes or no vote. And then whatever the result is whatever the result is. It has nothing to do with wheeling and dealing. Wheeling and dealing only has to do with, you might say, politics and people trying to manipulate their way into getting laws passed that the majority doesn't want. If you have just a straight vote, then the majority always wins.
But in terms of collaboration, I mean, I guess I'm thinking in terms of committees. You know, if you're in an office environment and you have a committee of six or committee of 10 or committee of 12, you have a good working committee to really pound out issues and get things done. But how do you have what's essentially a committee of 10,000 people?
Well, I mean, the committees currently aren't 435 or 535 when they have those kind of meetings. You know, you always have subcategories and people who can work on things that are interesting to them, but the whole point of the way the Constitution was set up in the House of Representatives in particular was to make sure that only those laws that were the desire of the majority were even considered or discussed at all. Because if you don't have a majority wanting something, it should never even be talked about.
That's what
the national law is about. We're not talking about state and local and city stuff. We're talking about laws being made on a national basis that applies to everyone. Those should be very few and far between, because it's very difficult to make a law in New York City that's going to apply to somebody in Hawaii, you know, necessarily. So they have to be very few and far between and very carefully considered, and the majority has to want it before it's ever, you know, brought up as a serious law. And then if it is, if the interest is there, well, then you get the committees to craft the law and, you know, all that stuff, and then you vote on it.
It's interesting to me that it feels like such a new idea. You know, here I am in the 21st century, and yet it's what the framers of the Constitution had intended well over 200 years ago.
And then, so they had put up with the Parliament. You know, they put up with kings and queens and all that stuff. They knew what limited, they knew what the dictatorships were like, and they knew what very powerful, limited organizations could do to the majority of the people. You know, the will of the people is not met when only a few people are running the government.
And then I'm kind of thinking through time. So you've got your, you know, late 1700s, and then the population increases and grows. And then by early 1900s, the 1929, 1930 time frame, you can understand why the House of Representatives capped their limits, because they're looking at a physical limitation of how many people can we put in one building in order to get something done.
Well, they didn't have the technology to accomplish what we can accomplish now. I mean, they did have the telephone, but they didn't have, you know, all the other things we have now.
And even just getting people from point A to point B, communication in the early 1900s was still quite rudimentary.
Right. There was one article I read a long time ago, as a little side note, that was titled, "Air Conditioning Has Ruined America." And it was something like that. I may have been paraphrasing, but the whole idea was that because they had air conditioning in the House of Representatives and the Senate, they could now meet year-round.
Oh, that's funny. Instead of having a shorter time frame, what made them get things done.
Yeah. Obviously, the less they did, the better off the people were.
That's funny. So then here we are, you know, so the House of Representatives caps its numbers at 435 in the 1929-1930 time frame. So here we are almost a century later with all this technology at our fingertips now and growing, because technology is growing exponentially. And now we're actually ready to have, now we're ready to have these conversations about going back to what the framers of the Constitution had initially prepared. It's interesting to me. It's almost ironic.
Well, you know, it's becoming an issue for me in particular, because everyone's talking about, you know, the Democrats doing this, or the Republicans doing that, or, you know, the Senate or the House or the President. And they're not realizing that the whole reason none of their wants and desires are being met is because so few people are being manipulated and lobbied and bribed by small groups of people with lots of money to do what they want, and they're making laws that have nothing to do with what the majority want. So a significant portion of all the laws being passed nowadays, which is quite a few, by the way, on a regular basis, are being passed because they're being sort of paid to make these laws happen to benefit certain companies, certain organizations, and the public doesn't even know about it. And over time, this creates this massively complex tax law, massively complex legislative law, and it just keeps adding and adding because it has nothing to do with the will of the people anymore.
And I'm uncomfortable you know, assuming that there's widespread bribery among our politicians' basement, but I do certainly agree with the idea that large corporations and lobbyists hold sway to a level that individuals like you and I certainly cannot.
Right. Well, most people are making a living, and they don't ever get to meet. I've never met any senator, I think, in my life that I can think of. You know, these are people you just never see and you're never in touch with, and that's a big problem in a representative form of government. And if they have to represent too many people, then what do you have? You have one person traveling around the state spending millions of dollars on TV ads and trying to present an image of who they are because you never get to meet them, and you're having to please so many people that all you can do is ride on the fence on every issue, which is what everybody complains about on politicians. They never give specifics. They never get into details because they can't afford to. Otherwise, they're going to turn off too many people. So by representing a lot of people, you have to always ride the fence on almost every issue and always talk in, you know, contradictory terms and never commit to too much. And that's exactly the opposite of a representative form of government. That's a political environment. The founders didn't want a political environment. They wanted a representative form of government. And so if you have one person representing one small town and that town wants something in particular, and you know, if it's a really strong need of that town, they might have 80-90% agreement on that particular concept. You would never achieve that on a national basis for virtually anything. So it's okay to be radical when you're representing 30,000 people. It's impossible when you're representing a million.
And from the individual standpoint, we start out the conversation talking about voter apathy, disenfranchisement, voters feeling disaffected from their government, the federal government. And so from the individual standpoint, if I know that myself and 30,000 people in my region are represented by John Doe or Jane Doe, and I have some kind of access to that person, more ready access to that person than I currently would, then perhaps at an individual level, we feel more empowered, we don't feel disenfranchised anymore, we have more opportunity to have our voice heard, our specific ideas, opinions, points of interest heard, and so you're looking at this as a true win-win for the individuals of our nation as well as the full nation itself.
Well, the benefits are actually incredible. I mean, the list of problems that Americans complain about that will all be immediately solved within probably a year or two is quite long. First of all, I mentioned some of these already, you would immediately have a situation where corporations would no longer have any power, say so, in the creation of laws, because there wouldn't be the ability to influence 10,000 people and pay them off. Political groups would no longer have any hope of getting specific minority-based laws for, you know, their specific wants and desires. You would have this gerrymandering issue would be pretty much a non-issue anymore because you'd have too many districts to worry about, and it'd all be very small. You would have representatives, say, in the city of New York. If you're representing 30,000 people in New York City, that might be just a few blocks. So you just walk down to your local auditorium, and you can talk to everybody within a matter of, you know, a few weeks, and then you're done. No need to raise any money, no need to travel around the state, no reason to go to Washington, D.C., because it has nothing to do with Washington, D.C. It has to do with representing what those people in your district want. Let me look up some other reasons here. Campaigning for all senators for all representatives would basically collapse. So there would be no reason to go to fundraisers. You know, if you're only representing 30,000 people and you're in that same city, how much funds do you have to raise to drive your car to the local auditorium?
Right.
So you solve all the money-raising issues, which then gets rid of all the influence and the corruption of the political process. You decentralize Washington power, so you, like I said earlier, get everyone out of Washington so there's not as much of advantage of bombing and terrorist attacks and all that. I lost my other list, but that's going to give you some ideas of things that would benefit from this process, and it would be relatively easy to implement. It would take people maybe a year or two to get the new system down, but I mean, when you're only representing 30,000 people, it doesn't take very long for that 30,000 to get together and then decide who they want to represent them, and it would be, you know, outstanding citizens in the community, like it used to be and like it's supposed to be, not who has the slyest way of talking and manipulating people.
So, Glenn, this has been a philosophical discussion of effective government, clearly not a political discussion, no specific parties and so forth, but a larger philosophical discussion. So what would you like to see happen?
Well, the public needs to know and understand this concept, because everyone's complained about things that have no solution unless we get back to true representative government. You know, you can complain all you want about what political parties are doing, but as long as they're bribable and as long as there's lobbyists and as long as there's too few people representing too many, we will never have laws passed that the majority wants, never have the kind of influence or control that the majority wants. So until that one problem is solved, America will continue down this path of, you could say, corporate greed and Wall Street influence and all the things that people complain about, that the rich and powerful are now in charge of Washington. That's never going to change until we get back to representative government. So I'm mostly doing this talk because I want the idea to be better understood and for people to begin talking about it, because I can assure you no congressman or senator will ever talk about this. It will immediately reduce their power by 99%.
Right.
So not people in Washington now are there because they love power, they love money, they love influence, and that's because the environment incentivizes that kind of personality and mentality. You're going to have this as a grassroots movement where we force the people in power or put new people in power that will actually allow this to happen. People who are there for the good of the country, not there for the good of themselves. And so it has to change at a grassroots level, and so the public has to be educated on this, and until a majority understands it and sort of pushes it and makes it happen, it's never going to happen.
Well, that seems like an excellent place for us to end this conversation right now, because we would like to have more conversations in the future on this topic and really delve into it a bit more.
Yeah, I'd love to actually get some comments from the listeners of this. They can write us at our company or send us on our website, neowave.com, and send us comments about it. Just would like to know what your concerns are, what your thoughts are, and we can see if there's anything else we need to discuss in a future interview.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Glenn.
Okay, thanks, Chris.